Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
This looks like an upside panic, a chase, a pure fear of missing out with the subconscious or conscious belief that there's no way Trump's going to let things go wrong, that he's going to tweet us out of it.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. I'm back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, so good to be back with you. So much to discuss today.
Yes, we have a lot to discuss, and it's great to see you too.
Well, I want to start here with this idea that I've never seen anything like this. But, you know, history rhymes. This isn't my first bubble I've been through. It's actually, embarrassingly enough, probably my third or fourth. People are only supposed to experience them once a generation.
Yeah.
So I want to start with what we're seeing going on in our financial markets by starting out with this idea that there's a narrative war at play, right? That the narrative is all important. And what's the narrative? So this was on the above the fold front page Yahoo Finance today, which is the 6th of May. And the headline reads, stocks rise on report, U.S.-Iran close in on peace deal. Subheadline, markets are eyeing signs of easing in Mideast tensions and impressive AI-fueled tech earnings. So I want to deconstruct these narratives a bit. But first, why would the stock market be going up on the easing of tensions? Because they've been doing nothing but absolutely skyrocketing with the increase in tensions. So now they're going to do better for the easing of tensions. That's the trouble with these narrative makers. They're always trying to like tell a story that fits what we're seeing. But
right,
I think they have to struggle a bit, you know, to be consistent.
Well, I think they do, too. But it seems to be that we're in the late stage cycle where fear of missing out and panic chasing is involved. So this is just part of late stage cycle. Good news is good news. Bad news is good news. And everything else is ignored because people are caught up in this just FOMO, fear of missing out, and the euphoria of the speculative attitude that we have in them. I mean, Trump said a couple of weeks ago, the world's a casino, and now we're starting to see it really look like a casino.
Yeah, and a casino where the rules are rigged in favor of the house, I would agree, because there's been some insider trading. We'll get to that in just a minute. But this, I want to just close in on the narrative structure. Stocks rise on the report that U.S. and Iran close in on peace deal. So that's, okay, so what happened was at 4:45, I now have the exact minute, an Axios article came out. And by the way, Axios has been dumping market-moving headlines this whole time. And Axios said the report was that, quote, the U.S. is nearing an agreement with Iran on a memo to end a war. I wasn't aware you ended wars with memos, but apparently you can. And the memo was just like this U.S. wish list. Like, we're going to see Iran committing to enrichment moratorium. You're going to see the U.S. agreeing to lift sanctions, but over time, U.S. may agree to release frozen funds. Both sides lifting restriction on Hormuz. They also said that in this memo that Iran was going to give up all of its enriched uranium, never enrich again, never seek a nuclear bomb, all kinds of things. And so this comes out of 4:50, and, you know, just about 7 o'clock this morning, of course, Iran comes out and says, nuh-uh. So they said here, quote, what U.S. media outlets are publishing about the details of the negotiations does not reflect the reality of what is happening, according to the news outlet Al Arabi, citing Iranian sources. Progress has been made in talks, but it has not yet reached a level that would lead to an agreement. Negotiations are focused on ending the war, not the nuclear issue. And the negotiations are still facing the intransigent American approach and excessive demands. So this is the U.S. issuing demands and saying, these are our terms, take them or leave them, right? And that's exactly what happened, because after Iran came out this morning and said, nuh-uh, Trump said, assuming Iran gives in, agrees to give what has been agreed to, not by them, by us, assuming Iran agrees to give what we agreed to, which is perhaps a big assumption, the already legendary Epic Fury, named by a 10-year-old boy, I think. It's awesome. Yeah. Will be at an end, and the highly effective blockade, where we were blockading the blockade to make sure the blockade that had some leakage of the blockade was fully blockaded, will allow the Hormuz Strait to be open to all, including Iran. If they don't agree, the bombing starts, and it will be, sadly, at a much higher level in intensity than it was before. By the way, they're all in on it. Here's Reuters saying the same thing. Oil prices ease. Markets rally as Trump works deal towards deal with Iran. Now, does that sound like a deal has been struck? Did I miss something?
No. That sounds like the U.S. is still expecting unconditional surrender, and we haven't seen that out of Iran yet. No.
No. But it's kind of an interesting setup, right? So Trump says, oh, we gave them this deal. If they don't agree to it, they already agreed to it. We think they agreed to it. But if they don't agree to this thing they already agreed to, we're going to have to bomb them again. So it's kind of like saying, no, it's your fault. Right?
Right. 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 Always finger pointing. We're the greatest. This is epic. And finger pointing.
Like Paul, I'm a car dealer. And you and I, you know, we're negotiating towards the price of a car. I go back in. I talk to my manager. I said, yeah, he's agreed to pay 2x the sticker price. Which you haven't. And I come out and I tell you, hey, yeah, 2x the sticker price or the deal is busted. And you go, what? You know, that's not negotiating.
No, that's not negotiating at all. It's not. It's demands. It's demands. This is what we want.
Yeah. But anyway, so again, but that narrative. So we're all like inundated in these narratives, right? The narratives. Reuters is reporting it and Yahoo Finance and New York Times, everybody's report, all the mainstream media report the same thing. Close to a deal. Now, we've been, this isn't the first time. How many times have we been close to a deal in the last 6 weeks? Every day, practically.
Every day. At least Monday through Friday. We get a little bit of a break till the futures open on Sunday afternoon.
Correct. Saturday, Trump is a tough guy. He's like, yeah, bomb them back to the Stone Age and end civilizations. And that's Saturday talk. But it's pretty much the markets are being talked up, you know, and there was just a interview this morning or yesterday came out, but I saw it this morning where Trump said, you know, I kind of expected a 25% market decline in oil to maybe hit $200-$300 a barrel. And wouldn't you know it? Stocks are actually up and oil's only $100 a barrel. So this is fantastic.
Yeah. With no hidden hand, no jawboning, no propaganda effort. It just happened to do it on its own in a completely free market, right?
That's the story. But hey, Paul, I'm seeing this like really big people. Like, you know, it used to be just some contrarians at the edge kind of squinting sideways at the markets, right? But a lot of people are starting to notice and question an invisible hand.
I've actually been really surprised by that because analysts that they don't want to push the edge too far, right? It takes a little bit of courage and you got to be in a situation where you're independent because if you're with a big corporation and you push that edge a little bit too far and you get outside control, it's job security risk. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It's not just the independent analysts that have to work for the you know, they only get the fee of the efforts of their research. And they've got a lot of followers out there. Now you're starting to see these analysts with larger corporations and institutions that are willing to state it out loud. And that's been a surprising mile marker to indicate where we are in this journey and just lack of integrity when the majority starts to say, hey, something doesn't add up here. That's been shocking to me, something that I've not really seen all in agreement until late 2008, but not even to the extent percentages of what we're seeing right now. They were still keeping the narrative coming out of, you know, the Fed. Hey, things are great. Housing's under control. Subprime's no problem. I don't know the percentages, but I'm just going to take a wild guess from my observation. It was maybe 40, 50% back then. It seems to be 75, 80% now that are questioning the narrative.
Yeah, because the narrative just doesn't make any sense, obviously, right? So we've seen problems with the oil prices, oil structure. We've had warnings from the head of the CEO of Exxon to the head of Carlyle, all saying, hey, all the major investment houses, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, you know, Deutsche Bank, all saying, hey, we are only a month away from hitting bottom of our tanks. And when that happens, all heck breaks out and still the narrative structure is more powerful than that reality. The narrative structure is this fake thing written by Axios. And again, they've been putting out fake headlines, market pumping, pre-market fake headlines the whole way through. Fine. But when they do that, they're taking us further and further away from reality. And right over your head, Paul, I see the history of bubbles. All of those bubbles have these really sharp rises and even sharper declines on the backside.
Yeah, I got to slide out of the way so you can see that a little bit better. But I mean, that's the blow off phase, and that's all the bubbles in. I mean, let's just go back to January. I mean, silver did the same thing, right? And even gold to an extent, but it was mostly silver. So I mean, this is happening in rapid succession across different asset classes, and I'll reference that here in a minute. But you know, they don't end well. They don't end well. And the question is, you know, especially when you have just this pure fear of missing out, upside panic, and I don't really understand where it's coming from. What I do know is it's really hard on the emotion of nearly every investor that's involved in this journey. And that's what bothers me so much. So there are individuals that didn't have a strategy, that back in 2016, 17, some back in 2008, recognized the issues we're in, didn't think that they could kick the can down the road this long, and they've been sitting in cash the whole time, right? These type of moves really make it stressful for those individuals, and the chance that they get sucked in right at the worst time, or maybe a little bit of instant gratification. And, you know, or 2017, even back to then. So even those that are in are feeling the euphoria, and they have a little bit of nervousness to begin with. But when this market takes off like this, they're all in. And then think about, you know, just the power, right? So if you're Trump, these tweets, if you're Axios, man, we're moving the markets. Everybody's paying attention to us. And that power leads to arrogance. And then you've got these insiders that are shorting. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it at this point, right? Like, what's the old saying? I always get this messed up when I'm doing it live right here. But, you know, what was it? Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, we know they're lying. They know they're lying. They know we know they're lying, right? The insider traders, they're not even trying to hide it at this point anymore, because there appears to be no consequences for them whatsoever. And the problem is they're impacting the citizenry and those individuals that are trying to do it the right way, trying to do it in the morally correct way. And it seems that they're just drunk in this power of, hey, you know, look, we're great. We're making everybody rich. But the consequences of not telling the truth at this point, because you've got the data. I'm really struggling with the mismatch of where we're headed at this point based on what the market's looking at. And, you know, so the question is the market right? Is it anticipating that we're not going to have an issue no matter how long this goes along? I guess it's a possibility, but the math just doesn't add up. So then you got to go back and look at COVID, right? I mean, it was clear that they were preparing everybody for lockdowns, and the market's just ripping right into the moment they're announced, and then it collapses on the other side. That's my concern. You know, not fear-mongering, y'all. This is just the reality of the situation we're in, and we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. But, you know, this is a dangerous game they're playing, a very dangerous game with a lot of people's, you know, livelihoods on the line when reality sets in.
This is how they've operated for a long time with these narrative structures, right? So if they can just jawbone the markets, and I know there's cash flooding into these markets because all my liquidity gauges are pegged red right now, Bitcoin and everything, right? So I know they're both visible handing it with their jawboning, and you know, their media allies out there are, you know, telling the talking points they want relayed, but also the invisible hand, money's coming from somewhere. And as you and I discussed last time, there was $172 billion of Fed printing already in the first 4 months of this year, plus the U.S. government's interest payments, which is stimmy checks to the financial markets, right? Principally. So we look at that, we say, okay, just the behavior of the markets since they're a sort of needle bottom, which we're going to have to take a look at that in a little while. It just doesn't smell right at all. Now, here's the problem. This all goes along fine, Paul, until it doesn't work anymore. And then we look at the chart over your head, and we get these ups and downs. I wish I could tell you this is my first time experiencing this. This is what happened in 2000, 2001, right? This is what happened in 2007, 2008, 9, right? Again, right? And it's happening again. And so that's a lot of bubbles for a single person to experience because normally they're so painful, you should learn. But they think they can just print their way past it. This is oil. This is sulfur.
Right.
This is urea. This is aluminum. This is helium. You can't print your way past these things. That's what's coming. And I'm just worried that these headlines, such as they are, they're designed, Paul, to keep the average person off the scent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the game, right?
They really are. And is it for arrogance? Is it for the feeling of power, right, with these tweets and this misinformation? Is it all for midterm elections to try to keep the markets up into the midterm? I don't know, but it's a dangerous game to play. And I mean, it's just a dangerous game to play. And you know, maybe now's a good time to kind of go back and reference. I just want to show, you know, just like silver, right? If we go back to here recently, you know, these blow off moves are awesome. And I love, don't get me wrong, I love the fundamentals from a long-term standpoint, but I remember there were a lot of folks that we were looking to kind of average in, and I'm like, okay, hey, let's just stand back and let this finish, you know? And the question is, but, you know, what if we go to $300 an ounce? That made a whole lot more sense at the point because the fundamentals are there, but when you get these type of moves that take place, you just kind of got to stand back and just be patient. That's the discipline part. And I know I've replaced, you know, control your emotions, basically, you know, work your plan and not your emotions. But still, it's hard all the way across the board.
Right. So silver is very instructive, and you get those blow-offs for what? They're market reasons. I think there's reasons why that chart behind you always looks the same, even before we had computers and futures and options and all the fancy things. It's that you have to, the way a bubble ends is you have to suck in the most number of people at the highest possible price. And then you just, I think they end when you run out of buyers, you know?
They do.
I think that some unfortunate person is the last person to die in World War I, and some unfortunate person is the last person to buy, you know, the NASDAQ at the peak, right? It's just how that works.
Well, and you're right. Information moves faster. You know, there was a period of time in the past where information was power. Information is commoditized now. Was commoditized. I'm going to change this a little bit. Was commoditized. So it's the wisdom to know what to do with that information became the power. Well, true and honest information is where the real power is right now. I mean, that's kind of how we seem to have changed. But let's go back and looking at the tulip bubble. That looks minimal right there compared to Bitcoin and the Tesla bubble that's referenced in that chart. But I mean, you didn't have computers. You didn't have that. I mean, we know today, right? Tulip, there's no reason to have a tulip bubble, but it's the human nature. Okay. So the one thing is, you know, money never rarely lasts through three generations. Really a good father is hard to find except for, you know, consistently in three generations, because those of us that may not necessarily have had a good father decided to choose a different path. And you become the father that you desire, but your kids have a good father, right? And then they don't understand the importance of it, and they get pulled into chasing the world and neglect their family, things of that nature. Money's the same way. This is all of our human emotions. This brings up a point. So I got to give Nick credit when we were talking this morning, and I actually wrote it down, and I butchered it. I didn't get all of it because I didn't want to interrupt his thought process, but we were talking. He says, you know, humans tend to overdo things. They overspend, they overeat, they overspeculate, and we might just be in the super cycle of overdoing things. And that really seems to be where we are right now. You know, what happens in private credit, private equity, there's a market space. It has, it solves a problem in the economy. But as success comes along and that hindsight picture looks really, really good, the people that are in that space are wanting more and wanting more and wanting more. They suck more people in. And the returns look great, and people believe, hey, if I'd have just done this 10 years ago, then I would have been here. And they assume that that's going to happen over the next 10 years. And then when everybody believes that narrative, that's where those bubbles come into place. And they forget the lessons of the past because the average person just doesn't enjoy history. The average person doesn't want to do the work, right? I mean, it's hard to lose weight. Some people it's easier than others. But if you've got a pill that helps you to lose weight or a pill that helps you to overcome eating, that's an easy fix. And I believe we're just in that peak environment where discipline, morality, honesty is not valued because of the wealth that our country's been through. And we've lost the fear of God and the fear of reality. And the fear, we have no fear of the ultimate outcome when we overdo things. And that pendulum swings, we have no clue where it's going to end. And then it reverses back with a vengeance. And that's what happened in the Great Depression. There were all of the investors that were really damaged when they were 65 to 70 years old in the year 2000. Guess what? They got hurt. They're out of the picture. They had to change their lives. Some of them are still alive at this point. They're 85, 90, but they're not the ones that's being interviewed on CNBC talking about how they got wiped out in the year 2000 and had to downsize dramatically. And the picture of their retirement absolutely got eviscerated because that's not what sells news. That's not what sells stocks. That's not what sucks people into this game.
You're talking about a reversion back to reality off of the fantasy, the dream, the hope, the fantasy, the bubble. And then reality snaps back. And you said people also don't like history. So history is kind of that's the reality of what happened. It reminds me of that little title card that came up in the movie The Big Short. And I'm going to leave one word out. And that title card says, "Truth is like poetry. Everybody hates it."
Yep, that's a good one.
Just left that one word out in the middle of that. But anyway, all right, so that's the narrative structure, and very well said, all of that. So beware the narrative, everybody. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Paul, here's what I'd like to talk about. I want to talk about this blow-off top. This blow-off top is this idea that, yes, we're in some kind of a bubble. Now, I was trained by a gentleman during bubble one, which we'll call the 2000 bubble, and he trained me in trading and all this stuff, and he said, hey, you got to beware. There's always this blow-off top at the end of a cycle, right? And the blow-off top is just this last parabolic thing that happens, and somehow you have to have it. I think you see that in the chart of bubbles over your head. There's just this last thing that has to happen. I don't know exactly why that's true, but it seems to be true. So can we just talk about this? This is the Korean Kospi Index. This is the equivalent of their Dow Jones 30 or S&P 500. Dude, this thing's up 45% in like 23 days. It's up like 100%, you know, since the beginning of the move. That's what a blow off top looks like. Full stop. That's what it looks like right there.
Absolutely. Eviscerates the shorts. Everybody piles in, and the fear of missing out absolutely takes over. And it sucks near every last person, and the one that holds their discipline until it's over,
yep,
experiences just as much pain, but is the one that's rewarded the most.
Well, and this is wild. I don't know if it's going to show up well for you, but I assume our watchers can see this. There's this little thin blue line. These are called Bollinger Bands, and they're a measure of sort of the upper and lower bound of a move that is sort of possible given the prior volatility that's just sort of happened. Very typically, you'll go up and touch the top. It'll trend along until it touches the bottom, touches the top again, touches the bottom, touches the top, starts to come down. This is the war start here. There's the Bollinger Band. I don't even know where it is on this thing. It just blew past it. But the warning part here, Paul, is the lower part of the Bollinger Band is now diving to the bottom. And what we would expect is that when this reverses, it doesn't just come back to here. It goes back to touch the bottom of this thing again, which is going to be way down there. So since I've introduced Bollinger Bands, this is the S&P 500 on a monthly or a 200-day moving average Bollinger Band. So this is a big, fat, beefy Bollinger Band. This is 200-day moving average. It's like that's the last 200 days averaged on a moving basis, right? And here we can see the stock market starts to sell off, comes below its 200-day moving average, actually breaks that support bigly. And then what is this? That is four standard deviations, meaning it's a very, very rare, unusual event. That's we're supposed to believe this is just normal market behavior in the context of the most damaging, most shocking energy shock, products shock, war in all of human history.
So we've got war. At least the government has not officially printed. Go back to 2020. Okay, yep. So you have the lockdowns, yep. Government yep. prints. They pay people more to stay at home than what they did. So look at that 200-day Bollinger Band. We have pierced through that, printed money, flooded the system with dollars, and you still didn't get this quick or as voracious of a move as what you did back then. And we're in a much more precarious situation here. I mean, even back then, the Buffett indicator was high and valuations were high, but we were not record-breaking high across the board. So this has to be just an emotional panic, late cycle, blow-off top move that's classic end cycle. It just looks like. That's mind-boggling to me. That we've moved this far, this fast, and broken all these records with the backdrop of what we have and the mathematics of what is likely coming.
I don't think I could have done it, Paul, without a little help from the invisible helping hand.
Yeah, obviously.
You know, somebody's printing money because, you know, now would be a bad time for reality to intrude on ego, greed, power, dreams of delusions of grandeur, all that stuff.
Right.
And people are going to get bored of us saying this, but we just hit another all-time new record on the Buffett indicator. It was at 223%. Now it's 227%, added on 4% of GDP since the last time we talked about it. And this was pulled on May 5th. Today's May 6th, so it may be even higher than that today because we're seeing another big cycle here today. So we're getting more and more and more expensive, but the narrative doesn't even make sense anymore. What's the narrative?
No.
AI is going to put a bunch of people out of work, and yeah. But don't worry, the companies, like, I don't know if you saw this, but it was Coinbase put out what I thought was one of the most disastrous press releases I've ever seen, where the CEO comes out with an AI written piece of garbage that said, you know, we're just getting so many efficiencies from AI, they're laying off 14% of their staff, right? I thought it was a disaster because he said our own non-technical staff are able now to use AI to ship production code. And I'm like, oh, what could possibly go wrong to have non-technical people shipping production code? But and you're in a financial industry where one little hiccup is like a wipeout, right? Anyway, but I'm reading company after company after company after company is making the same plans. And now we go back to that Henry Ford statement. Inverted from way back when he said, you know, I pay my workers the then unthinkable wage of $5 a day because I want them to buy my products.
Right.
If every company is going to lay off workers, but they're going to become more efficient, be able to sell more of their stuff cheaper, the question is to whom?
Right. To whom? But let's go back to Henry Ford. He was there building, had relationships with people that he was working with, a completely different time. Society had come through a lot of hard times. Of course, I know that was, you know, heading up into the Great Depression, all of the stuff that comes outside of that. But there was relationship. These individuals, especially in the tech industry, are so detached from the average person. They're so wealthy that, you know, it's like the Hunger Games, and they're in the Capitol, which has no understanding of what's actually taking place with the rest of the sectors. And it's been a long time since I watched it. It just popped in my mind, so I went with it. But, you know, the reality is they're so detached. They're more interested in trying to be wealthier than the average than their peers, because they don't even have relationships with the average worker that's out there. They're just a number, right? You know, they're just a number out there somewhere. They're data on the spreadsheet. Oh, it's terrible, so I'll give a little money to support this, or I'll support this cause and whatever. But and at the same time, that arrogance that they have, they think the rest of humanity is stupid because they've not accumulated all this wealth, and they kind of deserve what they get. It's we're just in the peak weak men and women in control, and they're given into their own desires and their own bragging rights for the wealth, and they really don't care what they do to the rest of humanity. Right now, they may get out and lie to us and tell us they do, but they're still chasing, trying to be the one ring that rules them all.
So the AI discussion is a bigger discussion. We've had it before. We'll have it again. But it just doesn't, the narrative just doesn't make sense. So what's the narrative driving this market? That the economy is just about to take off? Well, in case anybody hasn't noticed, there is a massive energy shock, but also a supply shock from all kinds of things. Again, aluminum, sulfur, urea, helium, on and on and on. There's all these things that didn't flow out of the Gulf, which are now just going to be rippling through the supply chains and providing inflationary pressures, right? And so what's the narrative there? We'll just skip past that, because we need Paul, is AI and chips. So this was crazy to me. Intel stock just did in 5 weeks, according to at Options Insight at Twitter, just did in 5 weeks what took over a year at the height of the 99-2000 tech bubble. And again, Paul, bubbles need two things: a story and ample credit, you know?
Yes.
So I'm not even sure I know what the story is, but the story is somehow this is amazing. But here, let me supersize this so we can see it. Look at this move. Comes here.
It's incredible.
This is an astonishing move from $42 to $110, right? It's just astonishing. And it did it in just a few weeks.
Incredible.
I've never seen anything quite like this, right?
I have not. Not in 28 years of being in the markets have I seen moves like that.
Yeah.
In multiple stocks, right? Every now and then you get some event that occurs with a small stock, short squeeze, but not in with this backdrop in this environment with names that are that big, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible.
Now, but this blow off top, let me be clear. This isn't U.S. centric. I'm not just sitting here banging on, oh, look at Intel and U.S. stuff. If the narrative is, well, the United States is going to be relatively better off because we still produce the majority of our own energy. Okay, you could say that. I don't know how we make the case then for Japan. Like, Japan's part of this blow off too. Look at this. This is over many, many months. So this starts in 24. This is 25. Here we are starting in 26. You saw the strong up thrust carries right into 2026. Oh no, the war. What war? Just Japan is so exposed to this. By the way, their bond market's blowing up. They're intervening in their yen on an almost daily basis now. And they import 100% of their fuel needs, which just pretty much doubled in cost.
Mm-hmm. No worries.
So their stock market's going up. No worries. But let me be clear. It's the Dow Jones. It's the S&P 500. It's the Nikkei, which we just talked about. The German DAX. Germany's so hosed in this story. I'm just going to laugh. It's that painful. But they're back poking around all-time highs. NASDAQ putting in new all-time highs. Russell 2000. Who knew, Paul, that the largest energy and product shocks in world history would be so bullish?
I don't know that anybody anticipated that. That's why their emotional reaction has taken over at this point. I mean, I would love to see a textbook study situation of, you know, presenting this outcome in a finance master's class or even doctorate level and see what their answer would be.
Yeah.
I mean, this is completely unexpected.
I know. But just tie it all together. Do you happen to have any charts that, the triple Qs or the whole Bollinger Band thing is crazy to me. Like, I've never seen anything like this. I've been through bubbles. I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah, this is mind-boggling. And it's something that we have seen, at least this is different than what we've seen prior to 2000, 2008. And this is the question of whether there's, you know, this hidden hand or what in the world has taken place. So this is the NASDAQ on a daily chart. We've got 200-day moving average, 50-day, 20-day. You know, when we started, we established a top back in October, and then we developed a range. Okay, and this range goes along. So we have resistance, and we fell there, right? Coming into February, then we've got the war in the Middle East taking place, the worries, and you have a big technical breakdown here, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, not only it's a couple of days below. I mean, one of the things we've done just to help increase probability of success is you wait at least 3 days when you break below before you're actually reducing risk. And then an absolute sheer panic vertical move. And this is as of today, which is what, Wednesday, May the 6th, we're just lurching out to new highs. And if you look at it on a weekly basis, I mean, you even close below the weekly 50-day moving average and a sheer vertical move. I mean, you know, the tariff bottom was a move, right? But at least you got a little bit of a pause, and then that continued on. But look at this, just absolutely vertical. And it's mind-boggling. It really is. And I could go through and show chart after chart, Russell 2000. S&P is not as vertical of a move as this. But, I mean, that's an absolute panic move. I could get it, and I understand if you've had a sustained downtrend. I can understand it if inflationary pressures had gone away, we're close to getting some deflation, and then the government just prints a massive amount of money. But none of the issues that are bubbling under the surface have been solved, right? So you've still got issues in private credit. You've still got issues in with private equity potentially. I've talked to several people here recently that have had real estate investment trusts that have blown up. The mathematics just don't work with higher interest rates. Interest rates are trying to inch higher, right? Now it seems to be every time we get over that 5% level, we get a tweet that brings things back down. So rates are trying to go up. At least, honestly, we've not seen this just massive printing of money that's handed to everybody. But the one consistent theme and narrative, like I was going to get to that base narrative, when I talk to both sides, right? So a large majority of people are in the middle. They don't have a party to identify with. They just want what's best for America. I've heard people on both sides claim, I'm an American. I want to be an American party, right? But the people on the right, the people that are on the far left, the one thing that they agree with in their belief, Trump will not let these markets go down. Right. Even those who mm-hmm. don't like him. So there's this belief that he's going to pull a rabbit out of his hat. And so far he has. Right. I mean, tweets and this and tell everybody what they want to hear and the market surge. And that just seems to be the one fear, the core of the fear of missing out that is causing people to absolutely ignore the warning signs that are out there.
Who can blame them, right? Because in times past, we've had these human-created dramas like the Great Financial Crisis. It was fundamentally just some paper promise tickets and weird contracts. You can paper over that stuff. What Trump is trying to do, and I'm sure with some helping hand kind of activities on the background, we're going to try and paper over a physical problem, which is the lack of oil and lack of products, right? You can't paper over that. So maybe what the stock market is sniffing out, which would be totally reasonable, is, hey, a whole lot of printing's about to come. Inflation's about to really slam home. So stocks is the place to be. Now, as you and I have talked about, that's not a MAGA sort of an approach, because when you say MAGA, the second word is America. That, to me, encompasses everybody. 92% of all stocks are held by the top 10% of families. They'll be fine, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, you can point to it, and I've heard Trump say, well, the stock market's up, so things are good. Like, yeah, for these 10% of the people, but the other 90%, they're going to get absolutely reamed by this program of printing. Just taken out with no care, no concern, no consideration, almost a complete indifference to their plight.
Absolutely. And let's just go back to what Michael Green talked about. And without the arguments around, let's just assume that it's true. that for the average household in the United States, you have to have a household income of $140,000 just to break even. Okay, that's the point where you actually have or start to have the ability to save some money to set aside for emergencies in the future. Okay, so if you're making $250,000 or more, then so what if you go from $90 to $130 on your filling up your tank, right? I mean, yeah, you notice it, but you're not going to change your life. But, and I can't remember what the median income is. I should have gone back and looked. What are we, 80, 89,000 on the median household income now?
Probably around 80 for median household, yeah.
Yeah, median. And sorry, guys, I should have known that. It's been 6 months since I've looked at it. But, you know, for those households, it's a dramatic change in lifestyle. These are serious pressures, right? If they own their home, insurance have gone up, costs have gone up, inflation is really starting to wear on people. And it's a major issue. And we look at it from sentiment across the board is very depressed. And this is just a terrible environment, because if you come out and you're printing this money and you're helping that top 10 or 15%, right, then we're at the point where extra money in the system's causing all of this inflation, and that's just going to continue. Now, the one thing that leads me to believe that the market may not necessarily be anticipating all of this printing, that I think it's more of a fear of missing out, lake cycle, emotional blow-off top, is because there's really smart people out there. If they knew that the government's just going to absolutely torch our currency and print a lot of money, yeah, it's good to own some of these big companies. That's better. But the valuations are high. And the question is it sustainable? And if AI does get rid of all of these jobs, who in the heck's going to be able to pay for the services to generate the trillions of revenue that they're going to need to justify all of this spending, right? I mean, and a lot of those people in the technology industry have mentors that had all of this spending for that infrastructure back in the year 2000 that didn't pay off immediately. It was 12, 13 years later before the stocks recovered their highs. So if I'm those people, I'm looking to commodities. I'm buying real things that you can't print. I may be buying manufacturing capabilities. Oh, that's a problem too, because we talked about it, I guess, probably 6 months or a year ago. There's a lot of manufacturing businesses that Wall Street and investors have considered uninvestable because China has such a lead that is going to be unable to be closed because they put tons of robotics and AI into manufacturing. So the thing is, okay, let's say that the hidden hand is keeping the prices of oil down. Gold, silver are not showing it at this point. That's something that big, wealthy individuals can do. Okay, let's say in that case that because of what's taking place in the Middle East, that's an emergency savings account. There's forced liquidations for those to repair the damage that's taken place. You should be seeing it in agriculture, copper, all of these things that we need that can retain those values that you can't print. Because if you go back to the Weimar Republic in Germany during their hyperinflation, you know, people would burn the money that they, the German marks they received, in their fireplaces to stay warm because the firewood that they had retained its value better than the currency that they had. So I would lean towards that a little bit more if we were seeing really high pressure in the commodities markets. And then, two, if you're a U.S. investor and they're going to torch our currency, you're better to own emerging markets and international and everything else out there. So, I mean, I'm not saying that those don't start showing signs here before too long, but we're not seeing it look like in those areas that should benefit the greatest that's what the market's telling us. So that's when I come back to the most simple thing. This looks like an upside panic, a chase, a pure fear of missing out with the subconscious or conscious belief that there's no way Trump's going to let things go wrong, that he's going to tweet us out of it.
Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. Paul, here's what I want to talk about. Can the real stock market please stand up? So we've seen all this spiking, the blow-off tops, the craziness, the FOMO, all this and that. But and I can understand it because Deutsche Bank just came out and said that this is one of the best earnings seasons in 20 years. All 11 top-level sectors are expected to show year-over-year earnings growth for the first time in 4 years. The blended Q1 2026 earnings growth, 25%. That's massive. And 85% of all companies reporting are beating their earnings estimate. Okay. So I get it. Earnings are doing great. Stocks go up because of earnings. Got it. On the other hand, at this point in time, what's called market breadth. So this is the comparison of the top line index value. So what's the S&P at 7,300 or something, right? Comparing that to the median company inside that same index, that's the breadth. How wide is that gap? And it turns out that the median company isn't doing all that well compared to the headline stock index. So that's on the other hand. And also on the other hand, and this is a crazy statistic, staggering, according to Jay There to Help One on Twitter, according to the B of A, four of the last five closing records for the S&P have occurred as decliners in the index outnumbered gainers. So more stocks are declining than are gaining, and yet the stock market's powering high. It's not ordinarily a very bullish thing to see. Carrying on, quote, in the month of April, just 23% of the S&P members beat the index, which B of A says is the fourth lowest monthly reading in the bank's database going back to 1986. So that doesn't sound so awesome. So which stock market is it? Is it, it's powering to all-time new highs, but you lift up the covers a little bit, you're like, wow, there's a lot of moldy bread in this bag.
Well, that makes me think of Tom Dorsey. So Tom Dorsey started Dorsey Wright & Associates, which is a research firm out of Richmond, Virginia. And I knew him really well before he retired. I learned so much from him, went to every time that I could to listen to him speak and talk. Paid for his research as soon as I went independent. And Tom would explain it in this manner back then, and I'll never forget it. He said, you know, in the old days in the movies, you generals actually led the battle on the battlefield, right? So Game of Thrones, Jon Snow loses his temper and runs out against John Bolton, and he's all by himself, but he's still willing to take the battle. Well, and the army comes up and saves the day, and they join him. So how he explained this, he said, imagine this. You're in a battle. The generals are up there fighting, and they have no clue that the rank-and-file army has tucked tail and run the other way. And that's when you know that the battle's very you're close to the end and the battle's about to be lost. And that's what it tells us. That's why it's important to look at those. They're terrible market timing tools, right? They don't tell you when this is over, but it tells you that you're in the environment where on the other side of this euphoria, things can go wrong. Now, that might change. You might see the rest of those stocks surge for whatever reason to catch up, and then that would cause me to be relaxed a little bit about the concern that I have in this, that this is a blow-off top rally. But that's a good analogy, something that people can understand, right? In the Jon Snow Game of Thrones analogy, he's out there by himself, but the troops come to save the day. It's a much better picture when you're looking at it. The battle's taken place and everybody went in together, but the generals, the Mag 7 and those leading this rally that are participating the most in all of this upside panic chase have yet to realize that the average infantryman has tucked tail and headed the other way. that's the backdrop we have right now.
Right. And let's peel the covers, open the bag up a little more deeply, keep the metaphor going, see if there's any other moldy bread down there. So as of now, May 6th, we've got the S&P's up just a little over 10% year to date. What's phenomenal about that is that Intel alone, according to the JPM Equity Desk, courtesy of Michael Brown over on Twitter, quote, Intel alone is contributing around 200 basis points to SPX performance, so 2%, which is nearly one-third the entire year-to-date return. Micron MU is another 150 basis points of SPX contribution. So the real question is, when do mutual fund managers finally throw in the towel and start buying? It's not just generals. We're down to like just the general's right hand. I mean, it's like this is like two companies, Micron and Intel. Intel, by the way, has been a sleepy dog since 2000. But suddenly it's become like this monster company for reasons that are not entirely clear.
And one thing I kind of want to point out about the mutual funds now. Index is up 7.2% as of today, 7.24 or something like that.
Okay, that's why it's almost a third there, 7.2. So then it's, 2% of that 7.2% is just Intel.
Just Intel. Yeah. Right. So the one thing I want to point out, the question that I would ask is I've seen reports hedge funds have been selling into this rally. The question is when do they get sucked back in if it lasts long enough? Most of your mutual fund managers now, by prospectus, have to be fully invested. They might have 2 or 3 or maybe allowed to have 10%. So, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's not like they're 10% cash and going to go back to 90%. Because if you're in a growth fund, for example, by mandate, they have to be 95% invested, as an example, depending upon what the mutual fund is. What I'm worried about more so than anything to add fuel to this rally, not worried about or just watching from the outside, hedge funds are selling because that's money that's actually tactical. They're selling into this rally based on all the data that I've seen building cash.
I've seen that too, yeah.
And what happens is, you know, if they go short, right, the wrong tweet comes out. The reports I've seen, they're not shorting the market yet. They're just raising cash. But you get kind of there. You start to roll over. They get positions short. Market starts to creak. Trump puts a tweet out that calls the computers to program. Then you generate another short squeeze on the other side. So look, for investors that are out there, what can you do? If you're not in, don't chase. I mean, you have to follow your own strategy and whatever's out there. But you just have to be patient, and you have to tread very, very carefully, because this is a dangerous time. It's a hard time. It's an emotionally challenging time, right? And I will say we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. And the good thing is, you know, if you've got rules and you've got strategy in place, it helps control your emotions and you can feel them, but stay with the discipline to do the right thing anyway. And sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. Right. If you've not crossed a decision point, you know, I don't believe that it's a great idea to chase this, because these things tend to end quickly and very badly. Like, look at the spikes that are on those. I mean, Tulip Mania, gold back in the 80s, the dot-com bubble, you know, housing's a little slower just because naturally it was slow, but you were locked in and you couldn't get out. Right. Private credit investors and private equity investors are starting to see that because they've shut the gates, right? So that limits the panic selling, but in the liquidity of the markets, you know, this can reverse very quickly. And it might run all the way into the end of July. We're in that period of time where momentum can carry itself into July, and you just have to tread very carefully, follow your strategy, and be patient, you know, and determine where you are. Are you trying to get rich? If you're 30 years old and you're trying to get rich, right? And that's your number one objective, you've got a job, you got 30 years ahead of you where you can work. If you get wiped out, it's going to hurt your feelings, but that's a really good lesson that you're going to learn. It's going to make you a better investor going forward. But if you're 65, 70, 55, 60, and you have achieved the asset level to where you are going to be able to retire and achieve your goals in that period of time where you're already retired, right? Know where you are, okay? Don't let that emotion suck you in there when you should be transitioning to prudent returns on your capital and protecting against absolutely getting wiped out, because history is full of warnings that you have to be careful here. And if it's not different this time, all of the valuations, everything is telling us that when this is over, and who knows when it will be, there's going to be a lot of damage in its wake, and you don't want to be one of those that has to ultimately upend your retirement because you let emotions take over reason. If you're 30, go ahead and speculate. You'll learn a good lesson. Now, I'm not saying go ahead, but you know what I mean. It's a completely different situation than it is once you're approaching retirement or in retirement.
I know, but Paul, I feel a lot of this right now, it's easy to get caught up in just sort of the headlines and how quick stocks are moving and all that stuff. But if we just get to a common, can we just go back to common sense real quick? Just a little fundamental analysis. The world is missing about 10 to 12 million barrels a day of oil. And that's still true today, despite the headlines, the Axios headlines, the Trump tweets. That's still true. That means that that's economic activity that's not going to happen because that oil didn't come out of the ground. Now, that can take place later, but we have this giant hole in the waterline of our global economic ship. Okay. And so we can already see it here in the United States with gasoline roughly $4.50 a gallon and diesel $5-$6 a gallon, depending where you live. As diesel goes up, diesel is the lubricant of the entire economy. I can just tell you, I can't tell you the details, but I can tell you grossly that there's trucking that isn't happening. There are orders that are being canceled because it's too expensive to move marginally profitable things around in the economy. That's economic activity that is not happening. So stocks are supposed to be trading on what the economy is going to be doing, but they're trading on something else. This is a chart of, it's the ratio of leading economic indicators to what are called coincident economic indicators. So it's a ratio, leading divided by coincident. Okay. So if this number, if this line is going down, it means the leading indicators are falling. The top of the, you know, division here is getting eaten up by the denominator. So the numerator is heading down. Leading is getting smaller. So this line shrinks like we see. And so what are these? People might not know. So a coincident economic indicator is things like how many employees are on non-agricultural payroll. So that's the payroll employment. So yeah, coincident. Like how many employees we got. If employees are good, that's a good coincident indicator. Personal income, less transfer payments. Transfer payments from the government, we don't really care. You know, that's what the government sends out. But how much is personal income? Makes sense. Industrial production, great coincident indicator. If it's doing great, your economy is doing great. Manufacturing and trade sales, all good coincident indicators. But those are on the bottom, and they're being divided into leading indicators. So the coincident indicators are happening because things are happening now. Leading is like, what's happening next? So that would be our average weekly hours in manufacturing falling or rising, average weekly initial claims for unemployment insurance, manufacturers' new orders for goods and materials, the ISM index of new orders, manufacturers' new orders for non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft orders, building permits for new private housing. Yeah, you get a building permit, then you build the house. It's a leading indicator. S&P index of stock prices, I think that's kind of a weak thing. They probably should strip that out. Leading credit index, very important. Are people borrowing more? Not, because borrowing leads to more economic activity typically. And interest rate spreads on the 10 years and also average consumer expectations. So all of these things are now falling relative to coincident indicators. So if we look at this chart, every single time this thing has come down, we've had a gray bar here. We didn't get one right there, but in 70, but we got one here. And then it fell, and we have another recession. That's what a gray bar is. And it falls here, and we had that double dip recession of 90-91 there, right? 80-81, sorry. Then we have this recession here, then we have this recession, and this one. But this is now plumbing a depth that we haven't seen since the bad old 1981 recession there and the 2008-09 recession right there. This is, so again, what's the stock market signaling? It's not signaling the real economy anymore, because this is what this is signaling.
And look, you can see there's clear cycles there and clear recessions that have come about as that has declined. That is something that is a warning. You're tracking the pulse of the economy as close as you can with that data. And you know, and in all that, yeah, the, and I take that in consideration. The S&P 500's broken out to all-time highs, so that's something that should actually lift those numbers, and it's waiting across the board, and it's still that low. Just you know, that's another bit of information to take and stack against the weight of information. And, you know, like the scales of justice, you've got a lot of concerning information that's weighed down on this side that the markets seem to be absolutely ignoring.
Yeah. So it's really a tale of two markets then. So we have all this hype. We have the AI. We have all of that stuff going on. Obviously, there's money has been poured into this. That's why you get those explosive moves up. Somebody was very worried about both the price of oil and stocks. Trump has articulated as much. And so I think we have the invisible hand is at play here, as well as just normal bubble dynamics. They happen, right? So once you get those animal spirits fired up, off you go. The problem I have, Paul, is that when, not if, but when this sort of corrects, there's going to be a lot of air under this. I mean, a lot of air. I think this could be a really devastating decline. Thank you for all the warnings that people really need to consider. Like, it's almost like, you know, this market reminds me of that scene in the movie Dirty Harry. Clint Eastwood points his gun. So do you feel lucky, punk? Do you? You know, because that's what we're facing right now is like if you want to play, you know, that game of wondering whether there's a bullet in the chamber or not, go for it. But otherwise, history's really clear about this. You know, things that are where you can't find, you know, what this fundamental, this stuff underneath that we should be finding in here, which would be, you know, this, if we can't find a fundamental reason that really comports with the other narrative, which is like, this isn't just everything's great, Paul. Everything's right. Perfect. This is like, maybe not perfect. The oil story, the other stuff, maybe not perfect, you know, but stocks are saying perfect. It's best to be prudent in times like this. So thanks for your warnings on that.
It is. We're at the point, right, where all of the information, the weight of the information, like a scales of a justice, because I try to keep that one way to fight confirmation bias. These are the things that I see are bullish. These are the things that I see are bearish. Right. So, and I force myself to do that on a regular basis because of the fact that, you know, when you're watching out for people, right, and it's your responsibility as a watchman to manage these assets and protect people, you know, you naturally, okay, hey, we expect a good outcome, but we got to pay attention to what the risks are. So there's a lot of times where I may see a major risk, but you weigh those scales and your list of positive things is way down here. So that tells you should get a positive outcome. We're at the point right now where the negatives far outweigh the positives, but you still got tweets and Axios news and all this stuff that's, you know, holding up the markets at this point. The problem is, when that doesn't work anymore, and at some point it's not going to work anymore. At some point it's just going to become noise, right? When everybody knows the game and more people are starting to understand the game. And if you're still heading in this direction, that's when you get the collapses. You know, when everybody believes that Trump's going to save the day and everybody's behaving that way, that's no different than the insurance belief that they had leading up to the 1987 crash. And that's my concern. My concern is this is a very dangerous time to pile in. You might feel good for 3, 6, 12 months. Who knows when this thing ends? But the problem is, you know, if we get that, I believe you're going to get a massive decline initially. And typically what happens, you know, you go back to 1929, not saying that's exactly what we're going to repeat, but even in 1929, you had a massive crash. Then the market rallied for a couple of months. Well, what you're going to do, I mean, this is just human nature. This is investing psychology. People don't like admitting that they've made a bad decision. That's why you have to take the emotions out of it, put your pride down and have some humility in operating and understand, you know, you're not going to make perfect decisions. You strive for perfection, but you're just not going to make perfect decisions in a complex market like this. But you get this big decline. Market starts to rally, and they remember all the times like it did here. You have a breakdown, you go out to no highs. So they hold on to it, and they have hope, and then you get a bigger leg down, a little bit of a rally and a bigger leg down. That's why people that make the emotional decision, you know, can't get out, right? Because they're scared to death on that first decline when it breaks all the support levels to go to cash, and they don't have the discipline to watch that rally and then be rewarded on the other end. And for whatever reason, every time we get these big technical breakdowns, which are major warnings, and you know, where there are strategies like ours that lowered a little bit of risk, okay, and then the market reverses to the top side, it causes people to ignore those warnings and further fuels that emotional fear of missing out and panic upside buy. We're late cycle. I don't know when this thing ends, but all of the handwriting on the wall and all of the evidence tells us that. It really does. And that's what concerns me, right? I'm not being a doomer for you listeners that are out there. I'm just talking about reality. And Chris, you are too, just trying to warn people, you know, be disciplined, be patient, look at the big picture, right? Know where you are in your investing cycle. You know, I met with somebody the other day and we took them through the retirement plan analysis. And one of the reasons why I love the retirement plan analysis, when we use actual history, is you don't get to choose when you were born, okay? There's a scripture that alludes to the fact that God chose the time and place we were born. Because you don't get to choose the time that you were born, you don't get to choose the window of time that you get to retire, okay? So it may be 55 to 75, depending upon where you are and the sacrifices you made to save, the assets you've accumulated, all that. That's a window of time, right? But the time you were born determines the time that you retire. You can't choose the economic cycle. If I could go back and say, hey, if I could choose and say, I want to retire at this point, I would have been born in the level where I retired in 1974, about the time the market hit its bottom, because 1974 forward is the single best returns we've had in all those historical analyses, right? If you were born where you retired in 1998, well, you felt really good in the markets for 2 years, overvalued, leading into economic indicators were declining, pure fear of missing out, upside panic, you know, a major personality that likes to hit a button, right? Buy, 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 sell, 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 was actively calling for Warren Buffett's resignation because he didn't understand the new economy. But Buffett was a disciplined investor that had a strategy. He looked foolish in 1999 because stocks went up, S&P was up 20%, and he was down 19, if I remember correctly. But when the market went down 47%, he was up about 35% over the next 3 years because he bought the things that everybody was selling to chase the thing. But for those people who retired and bought into that story, I mean, I remember meeting a guy in the year 2000 that had an advisor tell him that he should expect 19% a year returns in retirement because that's what the S&P did from 1990 to 2000, somewhere around there, and that he could take a 10% distribution off of his investments. Mathematically, you're out of money fast. Well, can you imagine 14 years of going sideways and how that upended his retirement lifestyle, right? Like, he disappeared. That was a conversation I met when I first got into town. And he was telling me what his advisor did and all bullish and all this stuff. And I'm like, but mathematically, there's no historical period of time where that's going to work. But he was fully convinced because that's the environment that they were in. The narrative's changed a little bit. It doesn't necessarily repeat, but it rhymes. But investors have convinced themselves of the same things, the ones that are chasing this fear of missing out, that it's different this time. And yeah, it's going to be different than the way that it happened historically. But it has to be completely different. And at least in the terms of history, it's kind of like playing Russian roulette with your future, you know? I mean, imagine the scenario. You spin that gun, terrible analogy for people that have had suicide in their families, but you spin that gun, you stick it to your head, and you pull the trigger, and you get $1 million for every time that you're successful. Well, you can do that 37 times in a row, and you've accumulated $37 million, and you fully convinced yourself that you have figured out how to beat Russian roulette, right? I am special. That's what investors fully start to believe at this moment in time. But the consequences of failure are so severe that it's death, and you don't even get to enjoy what you've accumulated being lucky. But I can tell you, if somebody did that, CNBC would have them on there going, hey, this person's figured out how to do it. If you'll just do exactly what they did, you can be as rich as them. That's what the media puts out there. And unfortunately, our human nature just gets us sucked up into that unless we're relentlessly and courageously pursuing the truth, however far it will take us. And there's periods of time, like biblically it says, if you give up your life, you will find it, right? And I think in that picture, investors are just imagining these riches that they're going to get in this market. They're ignoring the prudence and the warnings of the past, and they don't foresee that danger, and they build a narrative of this life that I'm going to have. And it may not necessarily be the outcome if history has any warnings and lessons to teach us. And we should learn from the mistakes of the past and press on to the greater achievements of the future. That's one part of the Optimist Creed, and I love that because there's truth and reality in it. And it's hard, guys. I just encourage everybody, keep telling yourself, I will embrace the courage to follow the truth wherever it will take me. And then that's going to put you down the path of wisdom so that you can make prudent decisions and be in a position to stand and weather the storm when it comes.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. We got to talk about this. So we've talked about this before. So AI, Paul, I use AI. No question about it. It's an awesome thing, but I can see both sides of the coin. I can see how it could be both awesome and not awesome, making us flabby in our thinking, taking jobs away without any clear design of how that's going to be like handled in the marketplace. But we've talked about this before, that it looks like a circular economy, right? Like, so, Google puts money into OpenAI that then buys, things from Google. AMD's putting, they're all just putting money into each other, and they're all booking it as accounts receivable, accounts payable, and revenue. And it's just money flying around and around and around. It's impossible to sort of figure out what this looks like. So somebody I follow on X, I really like how Ross Hendricks put it, and he said the bubble in AI, the bubble's in the E, not the P, in today's P-E ratios. It's in the earnings, not the price, in the price-earnings ratios. He says, quote, the hucksters and talking heads will, as they always do, fail to realize until it's too late, but it's very simple setup. Hyperscalers give OpenAI and Anthropic cash to pay for hyperscaler computing capacity. That cash circles right back around into the earnings of the hyperscalers. Meanwhile, free cash flow, it's an accounting identity, free cash flow. You get a free cash flow statement, you get an income statement, you got a balance sheet, etc. But anyway, so free cash flow for the group has officially gone negative, and they're raising records amount of debt, both on and off the balance sheet. Where have I heard the off balance sheet stuff before? To plug the gaping holes in their financial statements. So, yes, please keep telling me about how Meta, Amazon, Goog, and Microsoft are cheap on PE ratios, where the E is a total mirage. Let us know how it ends. Hint, not too well. So here's an example of that. Google, 3-4 days ago, committed $40 billion to Anthropic. They're going to invest in Anthropic. Anthropic reportedly is going to spend $200 billion with Google over the next 5 years on cloud and chips. That's awesome. $200 billion over 5 years. Should we note that according to 2025 revenues for Anthropic, revenues were well below $5 billion, but over $5 billion in losses. Paul, would you ever ink a $200 billion deal with a company whose most recent financial statement showed $5 billion in losses and that was their best year?
No, not unless they had so many investors with so many deep pockets that they would just keep piling that amount of money in for the next 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be a mirage, and there's other places where this mirage could kick out. For instance, you and I have talked about it before, that the federal government passed for itself a bypass accounting rule called FASAB 56, which allows the federal government to hide off the books certain expenditures if it deems it in the national interest, and can also have companies fudge their books if they deem it in the national interest. Now, we don't know how many times that's been invoked, if ever, but the rule sits. So it's a thing. But you and I both know if the government has a rule that's favorable, it'll use it. And I don't know if you saw, but meanwhile, there was huge backlash against a Texas data center because they have so many going in, and people started to get concerned, public backlash. But it was suddenly declared that this is now a military installation, has national security implications, and so local concerns kind of get overridden. So they've already declared it a military installation, one of these data centers. So I think it's not too much of a stretch to suggest that potentially there's some money flooding into these companies that we can't see, that's not publicly available, right?
Right.
I don't know if you
and
saw
that's our taxpayer.
Yeah.
That's our taxpayer dollars maneuvering in to help private equity and the top 10% that actually own the stocks, right?
Yes.
Wow. I had heard that there was issues with it and an uprising against it, but I did not hear that they called it a military facility.
Yeah, wow. I caught that on Vigilant Fox's channel on the Daily Pulse, which I was on that show recently with Maria. So, okay, so maybe there's a little public money sneaking in, but Ross mentioned the free cash flows. Paul, this is astonishing to me, really astonishing. Kevin Smith, CFA, look at this, the free cash flows for these big companies. So this is Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Google, Meta, Oracle. Okay, got the big five here. And you can see here, starting in 2016, their free cash flows are just climbing and climbing and climbing. 2022 is kind of a bad year. Climbing, 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 right up here until about 2025, and then they just fall off a cliff, and now they're actually negative. Collectively, free cash flows are negative. Every free cash flow dollar that's coming into these companies who are reporting the earnings, right, because the earnings show up on the income statement, so you can report positive earnings but still be hemorrhaging cash because the free cash flow statement is what cash came in, what went out, and what usually goes out is investments. So we know they're pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into CapEx at this point in time, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
If I see the free cash flow of a company dive like that, I will sell that stock every time.
Right. Right, right, yeah.
I'm not saying because go short because that's dangerous business, but if you have these stocks, you ought to know about this chart.
Yeah, I asked somebody. Somebody asked me, said, do you go short? And I said, we have the ability to go short with a small percentage of the portfolios that we're managing, but the likelihood of that happening with the Fed backstop and tweets and all that stuff, don't be a hero. Mm-hmm. Add the great taking risk over the top of it,
right,
what that does to the derivatives complex. Just sit on the sidelines, right? Don't try to be a hero, because if we revert back to the mean, sitting on the sidelines is going to put you in the absolute best position if you have the courage to buy when the opportunity comes. But yeah, I mean, that's a big deal, and that's unsustainable. Right? I mean, they're utilizing all of that free cash flow. That investment's going to have to generate trillions in returns to be able to justify that outlay. And it seems they believe that it's going to.
Well, it looks like that Kevin's poised put in here some sort of a very wide-jawed dinosaur era kind of a thing, because the red line is the S&P 500. You can see it rises right along, and it makes sense, along with the free cash flows, which fundamentally reflect earnings over the long haul. So right along until right here, and then this is this whole thing since the 2025 liftoff here, and then this liftoff. So this is the jaws. This is a giant. That's a giant gap. So one of two things is going to have to happen. These free cash flows are going to have to just spike all the way back up again, or the red line's probably going to have to come back down again, given the over preponderance of weight, market weight of just these five companies. What is it? 43% mm-hmm. of the market. It's pretty big. Something big
somewhere
like that
around there. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, but that's okay, Paul. Free cash flows, they're making investments. They've invested in data centers. They put all this money into data centers. And you and I have talked about the fact that these data centers, I'm a little concerned about the accounting, because they're made up of both durable but not so durable components that they've invested in. So the chips they put in there might last 3 years. They literally burn up, maybe 5 years. But they're pouring hundreds of billions into these things that have to pay off within 3 to 5 years. So how's that going to happen? Well, that's okay, because, Paul, these companies, they have enormous booked future revenues. They're booked. They're booked solid. Look at this. Look at the spending commitments. Microsoft has $627 billion of spending commitments and other revenue backlogs. Oracle has a half a trillion here, $553 billion. Google, $467 billion. Amazon has $464 billion. Huge. Uh-oh. Problem. About half of this is coming from just two companies, OpenAI, which is ChatGPT, and Anthropic, which is the Claude series. Just these two companies have committed to $1 trillion over the next 5 years. These companies are hemorrhaging money. Where are they going to get $1 trillion from? I have to laugh. Paul, it's that silly. This is, oh boy.
That's a really good question. And look, Chris, help me here. What am I missing? If AI achieves what they say that it's going to achieve and nobody has any jobs left, right, it absolutely eviscerates the management class, your higher income salaries, works its way down. You don't need receptionists. You don't need somebody to read a radiology scan. But where's the money going to come from to generate that revenue? That's my question, right? Are they just... they're just going to be feeding each other in this loop, and those are the only companies that are out there, and we're some dystopian movie where we're all at the farm and get a universal basic income, and we grow our own food. Oh, how much of the country can actually grow their own food, right? So where's the revenue going to come from?
Nobody seems to be asking that yet, but that's coming. But this is the history of every bubble over your shoulder there, right? There was a story equally compelling about tulips and railroads and houses and right? It's always a story, right? Because again, for a bubble, you need a story, you need credit. So what I didn't pull up was the chart of the borrowings, because they're out, they're burning free cash flow. So they got to get the cash from somewhere. So they're borrowing like crazy for this too, right? Which is why last week or the week before, you and I talked about how Jamie Dimon said there could be this credit market issue that could be really massive and more. So it could be terrible, is the exact word. And that could be the private credit, but it could also be that we have some of our biggest companies are borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars to throw into these data centers, and nobody has been able to tell me where that money's coming from. Is it because I'm going to do a subscription service for AI? Well, China's released all of their DeepSeek models open source. It's free.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hard to compete with free. Like if Anthropic suddenly says we're gonna have to charge you $600 a month, Chris, for access, I'm like, I'll use DeepSeek.
That's right.
I don't. What even is the business model?
You know, they really haven't done a good job laying that out for us. They just present the opportunity and create this FOMO. But yeah, what is the business model on the other side? I've not heard anybody say how they're going to generate this revenue if people have no jobs.
I understand how individual companies can become more lean and more efficient because AI is really amazing. Okay. You know, a few years ago, I was thinking of getting a research assistant. Don't need one anymore.
Right.
Right. So I understand that. I get that. But at the same time, when we macro this out, right, we can't all not be working, you know,
no,
it just doesn't make any sense anymore. I don't get it. I don't know.
So we're adding somebody else here and actively looking to add somebody else in account opening, customer service, you know, transfer process standpoint. But I've also embraced a lot of AI tools that we have been able to bring in that are going to shortcut and take pressure off of the team as far as some of the service things they're doing and infrastructure work. It's going to free up a ton of time. But it's probably going to keep us from having to hire three other people, actually four, so three people less down to one, right? That's less employment demand. So even in a service business like I am in the investment side, right, you're right. Research is easy to come by now at this point. We still have research that we're paying for, but there are a couple of things that I needed to that you can get access to that research through AI. And so, I mean, it's already having a slow impact on the economy, at least from my perspective and other businesses that I'm talking to, that, hey, we're not going to have to expand at the pace we are, and hopefully we can provide better customer service. That's good for profits in the short run, but that's also less people that are able to have the spendable income to go out, and that's already slowly happening. If it starts happening in mass, How does that business model work out?
I don't. It doesn't, obviously. It just doesn't make sense. That's a big thorny problem, and people are going to have to think about that, not just from the investing standpoint. I mean, as a father or grandfather, you got to start, like, what kind of a world is coming? I don't even know. And, of course, the big fear that I might have is that we'll get completely dependent on AI. It's totally amazing. Like, I won't know how to fix anything because all I have to do is grok it up. I had a problem with my harvest rate freeze dryer. Grokked it up, Paul. It was the best answer I ever could have had. It had pictures, little arrows it was pointing in. It laid the whole thing out perfectly, right? That normally would have been an hour service call with somebody, you know, to try and help them understand what my problem is and walk my way up to somebody who actually knew what they were talking about. But now it's just like instant, right? But what happens if we get all used to it and then it blinks out for some reason? You know, pick your reason, right?
Oh, that's going to be tough.
Right?
Well, maybe the benefit is this. Like, a couple of years ago, I had a problem with my excavator, and I had to do some work on it. And you couldn't find any mechanics at the time to do it because they were so busy elsewhere. They're like, we'll get to you. It's going to be 5 weeks. Now, back then, it was YouTube, and then now it moves to, you know, you could find somebody to teach you how to do it, and now you move to grok. The only benefit is, in a lot of things that I'm doing from that standpoint, once you do it, you learn it. But you've got that access at your fingertips. The problem is, and this is what I try to teach the kids and tell them, is like, look, you're going to live in a period of time where the economy is going to change dramatically, right? It's going to change dramatically. So your number one objective is learn to be a problem solver, be curious, and be a problem solver. That way you train your brain to be able to adapt to whatever's taking place and figure it out. That's the best advice I can give at this point, because we don't know what the future looks like if what they're telling us is coming is coming.
Well, I agree. Now, carrying on here, so Ross also put out this tweet where he said, quote, the entirety of the earnings per share EPS bull market consists of A, hyperscalers booking EPS today at the expense of the free cash flows we just looked at, and a tsunami of future depreciation on all that hardware that's just going to go away, and B, the semis, memory, energy companies all enjoying windfall profits from temporary shortages as we try and build out all these data centers willy-nilly. In other words, he says, a mirage. I can't disagree with that.
I can't either. And I'll tell you, there may be people out there that can understand this. So when I started trying to learn crypto, and I can't remember when it was, but this was early, I was like, well, the best way I can do this is to build a Ethereum mining rig. Because at that time, Bitcoin. So I get 16 GPUs before the prices go up, get somebody to help me. We build it, put it in here. Phenomenally profitable for 12 to 15 months. But then all of a sudden, faster GPUs came out, and all of a sudden I couldn't mine anymore, and it wasn't worth the $250 a month and extra power bill that it was generating. And then the cost of those went up. So, you know, that lasted a year, year and a half, and technology is moving faster now than it was before. So you put all of this in there, and then all of a sudden somebody else has the capital because they, you know, they waited it out a little bit longer, and then they move quicker than you do. I mean, it's deflationary from that standpoint long term, and that's a huge depreciation because they're going to have to continue to upgrade and upgrade and upgrade and upgrade to stay ahead. And where's that capital going to come from a long term standpoint? Because they're using funds that they have, you know, free cash flow that they have cultivated over decades to get in the position to be able to spend this free cash flow. So where's the accumulated savings going to come from if you're always behind the eight ball trying to update on in a space that's moving quicker than ever?
Yeah, but if you have to 10x your revenues just to begin to make your commitments, and you have to do that in just 3 years, that's probably not going to happen.
Right.
You know, probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. Unless there's some magic money-making thing in here I don't quite understand, which is possible. But I've, Paul, this is my first rodeo. I remember at the time when I was back in the day, I was watching, they're like, oh, you know, the internet is worth, pets.com is worth so much because look how many eyeballs are on their website.
Yeah.
You know, I was like,
I forgot about
so
that.
So there's
That's
web,
right.
So eyeballs. There's eyeballs. You know, I was that guy. I was like, yeah, so, you know, you still have to convince somebody to pull out some money and make an order, right? And the your order processing flow has to be efficient enough that you make a profit on everyone. And we had all these companies that were actually losing money on every order. And it was somehow a good thing that they had more orders coming in, because someday they were going to get back to, you know, they were going to turn that around and become profitable because they would figure out how to operationalize it. Never happened, right? The rest is history. I have the same feeling right now. They're like, don't worry, Chris. There's going to be these amazing profits in the future. We're just going to have to wait and see what those are, right?
Right.
I've heard this before.
Yeah, we've seen it. And yeah, the average consumer in the U.S. is in the weakest position that they've been in the past 20, 25 years. It'd be a different thing if people were saving 20, 30%. They could absorb these price increases that are across the board. But where is it going to come from? Right. The if they're successful, the profitability is limited to a handful of companies. The rest of the companies, just looking at the data we've discussed as far as participating in the rally and new 52-week lows, don't seem to be participating in that. So where's the revenue going to come from? I mean, that's the big question.
Stimmy checks? Yeah. I hear they're on the way. Bessent was talking about stimmy checks today.
So we're going to print our way into happiness and just ignite inflation, right?
Because inflation helps the few and hurts the many. And that's, as far as I can tell, that is the only thing I'm sure my government stands for at this point in time.
Yeah.
They're totally indifferent to the plight of the many. Totally indifferent.
Let's see. I can't remember exactly what the income was on one of the plans I ran here recently, but the mathematics was still pretty close. I think it was somebody that I did an analysis on. They needed $100,000 a year of income after tax to retire, right? So I think Social Security was about $45,000 of that between the two of them. So if we indexed it at 3.5% inflation, don't hold me to the math, but this is close and where it is. 3.5% inflation, retired at 65, lived to 92. They needed somewhere around $3.8 million total of income, okay? Social Security, I can't remember the number on that, but their investments had to generate X amount. If we do 5.5% inflation, they needed like $6.5 million worth of income. So that meant that their assets were going to have to fill that $3 million gap. If we got 7.5, the numbers start to get astronomical. And I get a little desensitized to it. No, I don't get desensitized to it, because quite frankly, it just pisses me off, because every single person I look at and I say, if you really understood, if the government was telling you that's the ultimate impact that you're going to have from higher inflation, they're like, oh, the country would revolt against it. You know, because people can't see that big picture. And that's why I like taking people and showing, hey, this is why, right? We have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us, because if we were on a gold standard and you had inflation for a while and then it reverted back to deflation, but you had essentially no inflation or maybe 2%, however much is being pulled out of the ground, it is control, right? But we're in a situation now, if the government just decides that they want to tell you inflation's 2.5 and change the numbers where it's 5.5, it's just this consistent monetary cancer that eats away at your standard of living, and people are becoming more stressed and more stressed and tighter and closer to financial collapse, that they can't understand where it's coming from, because nobody is explaining the long-term impact of what takes place. And that, you know, and I have people consistently say, now understand why I don't need to bury my money in the backyard and I have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon me. I don't like the game.
Money printing forces you to take risks. You have to take risks. You may not opt out of the game. Yep.
There is no conservative way to protect yourself against that risk unless you've accumulated so much money, right? If you've accumulated $20 million and you can live on 3% of that and you don't mind using it all up, I think I did a number in a case like that, you know, if they retire at 65, live to 92, is 7.5% inflation, they could sit into treasuries and have enough money to last till they're 95, right? If inflation was 7.5. So that's the most evil part about this is we don't have a choice. We can't control the rules of the game. It's ridiculously impactful. I try to educate every single person that'll listen to me without thinking I have horns coming out of my head about those impacts. And, you know, it's like we've got the election cycle here going for state Senate and several things, and I've had a lot of people call and want my support. So I've sat down with them and I'm like, are you going to deal with this, 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 and this? And they look at me like deer in the headlights. They're like, what is inflation? Right? Like they have no clue. I mean, conceptually, but then I show them what the impact of those policies are and they're like, oh, I see. Now I get it. But then they go back out there and try to get elected, and nobody wants, you know, you sit up there and talk about the perils of inflation from a long-term standpoint, and people believe that oh, all that does is make the stock market go up and make me richer, so it's okay. And it does until it doesn't.
Yeah. Have you seen there's this whole new trend out there on Twitter or on TikTok where people go into the stores? So inflation's one thing, Paul, but have you seen this? This is widespread. I've seen probably 20 separate videos exactly like this one. Here's a guy. Let's see what he says here.
It even says on them 3 pounds. Let's weigh them up.
So a lot of you guys talk about Walmart produce. You talk about the potatoes, you talk about the apples, you talk about lots of stuff. You put it on the scale and it's not weighing. Come, let me show you what I found. So these sweet potatoes right here are supposed to be 3 pound bags. It even says on them 3 pounds. Let's weigh them up. 2.64.
Oh my goodness.
And I've seen also this woman, she opens a pack, it says pack of screws, says 100 screws, opens it right there from Home Depot, counts them, 73 screws, right? So it's not even that we have to deal with, like, inflation. Like, corporations are openly ripping people off now, right? And they say, yeah. Oh, you know, sometimes there's some, you know, they can lose moisture. Like, now, sweet potatoes do not lose a half a pound of moisture. Sorry.
No.
It's not how that works.
No, an honest company is going to say 3 pounds and it's going to be 3.1, 3.15 because you're delivering a better product than what you're saying that you are.
Yeah.
But gosh, Chris, I mean, that just breaks my heart. That's just a sign of that good men and women create good times. Good times create weak men and women. Weak men and women create hard times. That's the cycle. You can see it in the bubbles that we've seen historically. And if you're so concerned about profit that you're going to lie and you're going to take that excess profit that you have about lying and buy off these politicians that are weak individuals because they care and worship about money, you know, money in itself is not evil. It's the love of money mm-hmm. that's the root of all kinds of evil. Money's a tool to be used. But it seems right now that, you know, I think I stated this not too long ago, that our God as a country is money, because that's what everybody is compromising their integrity for. And there's no fear of God, and that's going to revert hard, right, to the mean. Throughout this, even if you don't believe in a God, throughout history, there's evidence that reverts back the other way. That absolutely breaks my heart, right, because that is completely dishonest. And those companies, at the expense of lying to their customers, are going to rejoice over beating their lower earnings, because everybody's earnings estimate were so low anyway, the game that they've got out there, that they can go rah, rah, ree, and look at me, and I've got, you know, my, you know, $10 million bonus as a CEO, but even my employees I'm putting the screws to, because my employees are buying the products that I'm not being honest about in the delivery.
Hey, Paul, if there was one dishonest shopkeeper, it happens, right? And you learn to avoid that shopkeeper. But whoever packaged those sweet potatoes was in on it. Whoever distributed them, they knew. And the purchasing manager, they knew. So there's all these people that know, and they're all like okay with it at this point in time. We're going to cheat our customers.
Yeah. And what alternative do you have?
With dishonest weights and measures.
Yeah, so, and that's the problem with monopolies. My kids were taught nothing about monopolies and the dangers of monopolies within school. When I was there, I clearly remember, you know, talking about monopolies and the danger, but especially in a lot of small towns. Like, one of the reasons I love to fish in Montana, you get in those small towns, they don't have monopolies in there. They have, you know, regional companies within the state, but there's a lot of towns that don't have Walmarts, and you've got all kinds of options and small mom and pops. But you get into small towns like we have in North Georgia, the small businesses can't compete with the Home Depots and the Walmarts. I mean, there are some that do, but, you know, especially with the Walmart as their behemoth, they just price everybody out. And once they gain that control, now they're going to do stuff like this. I mean, that's just absolutely evil. I have no other way to put it. It's deception. It's lying.
Just over and over again. This is a woman who discovered that even in canned products, it doesn't, what they say is in the can is not actually in the can, right?
Yeah.
So this, you can't even claim that there was like a moisture loss or something like that. So, I mean, look at the size of those things filled up, right? Like it's half full. And it says X ounces on there. She dumps it out, and it's about 50% of what's supposed to be in there. So there's inflation, there's shrinkflation, and then there's outright fraud. That's fraudulent, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned, right there. That's fraudulent. And there's supposed to be a government regulatory body that's overseeing all of that, right?
I mean, look, it's clear as day that the justice system does not help the people it's supposed to be helping. It obviously seems to be working to the people that have enough money. You can pretty much get away with anything. And if you're lying about that and you're creating all these profits at the expense of the average person, you've got the revenue to be able to go fight the system and pay off the right people. Sorry, I'm getting a little angry right here.
No, I got to get there, too.
Yeah, I mean, that upsets me to no end. Absolutely upsets me.
Well, it's corrosive to society. It's not good. That's not how you build a healthy, stable society.
Yeah.
Then everybody starts cheating, and next thing you know, it just breaks down. I mean, I read this book, and I interviewed the author years ago, Darren Acemoglu, who wrote Why Nations Fail, right? And he said, it's really bizarre because you could have two countries, almost identical, populations, resources, like they had all the things. And so some nations prosper, some fail. And he said, it wasn't any one thing. We like to say, okay, socialism. He's like, yes, if you have a bad political structure, that can really hamstring you, right? But it's not the only defining factor. So it really came down to your culture, your morals, the particular model you chose, and your enforcement of all of the above, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we can see that we don't, our model, people say we have capitalism. We don't have capitalism anymore.
No.
In capitalism, a company that makes a defective product that kills people goes out of business very quickly, yet pharma companies are still kicking around, right? In a functioning economy, you don't have insider sales that go off with no enforcement. You don't have lack of enforcement of basic things like product sizing and weights and stuff like that, right? You know? So the things that these are all, what I'm trying to lay out is that the things that would give you why we were successful as a country in each of those four areas, you can just see erosion, if not complete collapse across all four of those at this point in time. And I don't want that, right? It doesn't have to be this way, right? It shouldn't be this way. If we weren't monkeying around overseas, spending hundreds of billions of dollars, killing other people, and we were instead attending to our own issues, right? Mm-hmm. We'd be a much better off country, much better off.
Far better off. And we would be far better off and have much more options and better customer service. If a corporation fell, like I was so upset when the government was talking about bailing out Spirit Airlines. I'm sorry for the people that are working for Spirit and the jobs that are going to be lost. But the reality is they have to go under. The taxpayers shouldn't be bailing them out. Let them go under. Let the people, let the leaders within that company get blackballed from the industry, and then let somebody else step in there and take up that product, buy those assets, offer a better product and better service going forward. I mean, that's literally what should happen, right? I mean, too big to fail banks. Okay, backstop FDIC. Okay. If you're over the FDIC limits, let that bank fail. They're not too big to fail, and let it shatter into a bunch of regional banks that are around that can make decisions that are right for that local community instead of somebody sitting in a back office 500 miles away making decisions with their political leanings against that local community that you're in that they have no relationship with. We need to get back to that's what we need to do and let those companies fail. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of jobs that are going to be lost. And that's a sad part about it, but that's capitalism because look, if the local J.P. Morgan branch was to go bankrupt because they let them fail, then somebody else steps in and opens a bank branch. Well, you can hire those employees that back that are in that local area to run that bank branch and offer better service, better loans, and better support for your local community. But it seems like this monopolistic attitude's gotten to where they want to have a few big banks where they can make make the decisions around the country. And hey, if you're a, you know, if you want your freedom and we don't want you to have that, well, we're not going to give you the capital for your community to thrive like we will this one over here. And that's the problem. It's that control that's in there. And that's not what's right. That's not the American way. That is not capitalism. Capitalism is, you know, if you fail, you fail. If you offer a great product and you manage your money poorly, like a lot of businesses fail for poor cash flow management, not lack of profitability, right? So you have to have a great product, team up with somebody that can manage your cash flow and your skill set, offer a great product and great service. And if you get to where you're too greedy and you're cheating and you're lying, the government should drop down right on top of you, put you out of business, and let somebody else step in and fill that gap that's got better integrity. But unfortunately, the halls of power is protecting itself right now.
Well, you know, speaking of those four elements, if one of them was your culture and its morals, you know, we used to live by do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And somehow that became do one to others before they do one to you. You know, it's like, so every man for himself, like, you know, so as soon as everybody starts ripping everybody else off, trust erodes. And that's the thing. We live in a high trust society. I like living in a high trust society. I love that. Living in a low trust society means you can't leave your car out. It's going to get broken. Leave something on the lawn. It's going to get stolen. Every deal is going to, somebody's going to try and cheat you. It's like that. Those are, that's why some nations fail. Low trust nations are never a good place to live, right? A lot of Africa, low trust, right? And that, because of that, that one feature, they just can't get out of where they are, despite having bright people and great resources, just, you know. So that's the thing. Once trust is easily broken, hard to repair.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
You know, and every time somebody weighs up a 2.5 pound bag, a 3 pound bag of potatoes, trust gets nibbled at, right?
And I'm glad that that came to light. I mean, I had seen the shrinkflation in the past, but it never, you know, I've seen packages get smaller and they cost more. Like my wife and I have talked about that a lot. That's been going on for a while.
But if it says 11.3 ounces on your shrunk package, you kind of assume that's what's in there, right?
And that's what the justice system is for, right? That's what the legal system is for class action suits to go after. But who's going to get it now, right? The attorneys are going to get the large majority of what comes out of that, not the people that have been damaged by it. I mean, that's just absolutely horrific.
Maybe AI will solve all this for us.
Right. Well.
All right. Well, so I think we're going to call it there, Paul. Thank you so much for your time today. And I just want to remind everybody that if you would love to talk with Paul and his amazing team, you go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a very simple form. Within 48 business hours, somebody from Paul's team will get a hold of you. We've got a really ironclad systems working beautifully. And you'll set up an appointment. You'll have the first of three calls, which is an introductory call, then a planning call. If all goes well, you'll have a recommendations call. And if everything goes well after that, there may be a decision between both parties that it's good to work together. And then you'll be in the Paul Kiker Wealth Management family. And it is kind of like a family there, isn't it?
It is. Carrie and Renee and I have worked together for 22 years, and the rest of the team, you know, has been 15 and multiple time. And the thing I love about them is they care about people, and they love the mission that we're on. You know, it's like all the advisors, some of them had a hard time getting to the standpoint of, hey, we got to run a plan before we come. But, you know, and I tell people, I've had people here recently that have called in like, I don't want to go through the plan. I just want a recommendation. Until I take you through the plan, you don't fully understand whether you're in a good position or a risky position. I'm able to demonstrate for you why I'm going to be given the recommendation that I give later. I don't give recommendations after the planning meeting because I need time to digest our conversation, your situation, and make sure we're given the right recommendation. So, but the thing is that plan, I've not had anybody that's gone through that analysis and walk away from it and say it was a complete waste of time. Consistently, it's like, oh, I knew it was bad. Inflation was bad, but I didn't know it was that bad. Or somebody thinks that they're going to be able to retire in 2 years, and I have to give them bad news and say, look, you've got a couple of options, right? Work a little longer, take a little bit less income, carry a little bit more risk. Maybe 100% treasuries isn't going to help you to be successful. But then they have the peace of mind of knowing they're doing everything that they can prudently do to be successful. We've got an unknown future. We don't know how it unfolds. The adaptability of our process, I believe, is important. And I have seen it being ridiculously important to clients through these big bursts that we've had early in the career and even some here recently. But it's an important process. We care about it. Everybody on the team, you know, loves the people that we have the opportunity to serve. And that's our mission, right, is to be the watchman and help people develop a wise and prudent plan. And if we have the opportunity to talk to you, whether we work together or not, it's been an honor. And Lord willing, you'll have something that makes you a better investor and better informed about your situation.
Well, Paul, the number one piece of feedback I get when people contact me after starting to work with you, they say, hey, Chris, it's a little bit disorienting working with Paul. I think he actually cares about me.
I thought you were going to say disorienting because I've learned to slow the information down. That's great to hear because I do. We do seriously care about people.
All right, Paul, thanks so much for your time today. And thank you for being here, everyone.